This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by www.starktruthradio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can read his articles and find out more on robertstark.substack.com. I don't bow down anymore. But when I was in a band on a cross-country team, I looked like the jumper off of the grassy. I love the Martian looking.
Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Mr. Raven. Mr. Raven, it's great speaking with you.
Super, super glad to meet you. So, what's up?
Yeah, I'm doing great. So, to start things off, if you want to just kind of give our audience like a brief introduction about yourself.
Okay, I'm a 58-year-old man. I live in a wilderness area.
Is that Gen? Are you Gen X, or is that close to the
yeah,
border
I'm Gen
X
X. I'm on the border of Boomer, but I definitely consider myself to be Gen X. Like, I came up in the punk subculture in the 80s, and, you know, that was kind of a reaction to the whole Boomer hippie mess. So, yeah, I definitely consider myself to be Gen X.
And if you want to just give, like, a brief introduction.
Sure. And I make laser-cut paper-cut art. I use LLM AI to do the designs and cut them out and map them. And I also work for one of the large corporate search companies. I'm under an NDA. I can't disclose, but that's my day job. I do a couple of hours a day as well.
We were talking about this in regards to one of my articles, but do you have thoughts on the urban versus rural divide and how it plays out in dissident politics?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something I'm very interested in. My perspective on things is that rural areas in the United States almost act like internal colonies, that basically the professional managerial class exploits the rural areas for food and raw resources, yet also manages to corral all the wealth in the urban areas.
And do you think that also plays out in dissident politics as well?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a divide. I know some people are urban like you are, and some people are rural. I think at this point, since the woke ideology is centered in urban areas, that there do tend to be a lot of people, at least on the in the right dissident circles, that are more rural.
And do you think a class divide is also significant in dissident politics?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think are you familiar with Sam Francis's analysis of the professional managerial class?
Yeah, I haven't read the book. I think it's The Leviathan, and then there's also James Burnham's Managerial Revolution.
Yeah, I pretty much go by that kind of model. I think class in the sort of post-industrial society we have is, in essence, the professional managerial class. And I live in an area that's rural enough that there basically aren't any office jobs in this area. So I would consider myself, at least in the eyes of society, to live in an area that would be considered to be of a lower class.
And do you think that also, yeah, how much does that play out in dissident politics? And how is dissident politics, I think, dissident politics, I know it's a very vague term and encompasses a lot of different online ideologies, but my assessment was that initially it was from more like the more traditional working class, like dissident politics that came out of the 90s, like Pat Buchanan's initial supporters is very much like a white working
sure.
class movement. And I think today, because of increased like elite overproduction, you are seeing people with more upper middle class or like aspirants to the professional managerial class with elite overproduction who are in dissident politics, both like the more Bernie Sanders, progressive kind of Bernie bro side, and then also on the dissident right as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a very poor person myself. I make right around the poverty level, but, you know, I have a 4-year degree from you know, supposedly like fairly high-ranked college, Oberlin College. So I will cop to having some resentment for the fact that, you know, I'm a well-educated person who struggles at the end of the month to both put milk in my refrigerator and gas in my car.
Did you read that article I wrote about the smart but poor demographic?
You know, I don't think I did. I'm sorry. If you want to make
that was
a
while.
Brief rundown,
yeah, it was a while back. I'm not even fresh on what I wrote. That was like maybe almost 2 years ago.
Okay. Well, what's the main idea in it? The the meat of the thing.
I'm not really fresh on that, but I just try to create a demographic profile of people who are, say, high IQ but economically struggling.
Oh, okay.
They don't fit in with people who are economically well off, but they don't fit in also with a lot of proles who might be lower IQ or less culturally sophisticated, that niche.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I moved out here, and I'll admit, I was kind of like a chud booster when I moved out to the countryside initially, but I have kind of soured on the whole thing. I've gotten kind of sick of the people roaring around in the woods with their ATVs and big trucks, being very aggressive and not very thoughtful. And there's no one I can really have an intelligent conversation with in this area. If I had one frustration with rural life in a poor area, that would be it.
So I'm from LA, which is a pretty different background as you. I think one thing that we do have in common is you mentioned that your background is upper class but downwardly mobile, and you have a lot of bohemians. You're bohemians in your family. That was sort of my background, is like more upper class, but like downwardly mobile, like upper middle class, even like outright upper class. And then also a lot of bohemians in my family. So I think we do share that in common.
Yeah. I have relatives in Dayton, Ohio, who literally live in mansions and whatnot. But my particular, and my grandfather on my father's side was the head of the Spanish department at Ohio State. But my father did art and craft festivals, so we grew up quite a bit more impoverished. I grew up in a house trailer, but he also, there's something I would almost call like the aristocratic bearing, and he definitely had that because he grew up in that kind of household. So even though we were poor, there were always a lot of books around and like discussions of even things like metaphysics when I was growing up. So it was a very strange situation in a lot of ways.
America is heavily like a new money kind of like mercantile culture, increasingly more like managerial. Do you think there are any remnants of like aristocratic values, or do you feel that's kind of a cope?
Oh boy, that's a really good question. I mean, that's something, you mentioned my essay on the medieval craft guilds and how I have a preference for the Middle Ages. If they're out there, and I would assume that there are some sort of blue blood people, particularly on the East Coast, and people like people in places like Maine, I haven't really had any contact with them. But presumably those people still exist that kind of, go out and see classical music, and they're members of the Audubon Society, and, have memberships in the Smithsonian and that sort of thing. I actually grew up in those sort of circles, even though I'm poor.
Do you foresee ethnic and cultural enclavism, which I write about, forming in the future?
Sure. I mean, I think it's already happening for all intents and purposes, People, because we do have access to information about the entire planet now, people, I believe, are self-selecting into areas where they think, they're kind of like culturally simpatico to their worldview and background.
In response to one of my articles on enclavism, you predicted that enclavism will occur due to an economic downturn, as basically easy credit and the wealth and power of institutions is what causes integration, but also upward mobility.
Yeah, I think, as I'm sure you're well aware, ethnically diverse areas tend to be relatively low trust. And I think if we had an economic downturn, people are going to be more desperate, there's going to be more crime, and that people are going to want to live in communities of people who are more similar to themselves they can trust. I mean, that's a theory, but that's kind of my theory on the thing.
Do you foresee, what do you think about like detractors who would say that enclavism could lead to neo-feudalism?
So by neo-feudalism, do you sort of mean like there's someone who owns a lot of land in an area and they rent it out? I guess I'm a little bit unclear as to what that
means.
Yeah,
it's not really well-defined because like there's not a good coherent definition on neo-feudalism, but some people, like more liberals, would say that it would lead to the destruction of like liberal institutions, and it could be kind of co-opted by like these local oligarchs and good old boy networks, would be like what detractors might say, creating but like a more kind of decentralized neo-feudalist system.
Yeah, I know Curtis Yarvin kind of writes about like enclaves or communities that have like a CEO structure. And that's one of the things I actually really disagree with him on.
Like corporate charter cities?
Pardon?
Oh, like kind of like corporate charter cities.
Yeah, something along those lines. Because, you know, really, one of the main reasons I consider myself to be kind of in part of this distant sphere is I don't really like corporatism or the professional managerial class. I tend to, you know, like self-employment and self-management and, you know, families controlling their own property. So if we got into a situation like that, you know, that's not really the kind of vision I have. Now, I can see it happening, especially in urban areas. It seems like it's more likely to happen as the people with more and more money buy up more and more land, like BlackRock buying up the houses and apartments and whatnot, and more people becoming landless. To me, as a kind of rurally oriented person, to me, that's a sort of negative vision of the future.
What do you think about like the economics of distributism, if you're familiar with that?
Oh, I'm very familiar with it, and it's something I'm very interested in. Before I identified as a right-winger, I was a mutualist anarchist. And mutualist anarchy is very similar to distributism. You know, it's sort of the idea that...
I think I've heard about it via Keith Preston's blog, Attack the System.
Yes. Yeah, I was a big Keith Preston fan back in the day. But I was into mutualism even before that. People like Benjamin Tucker and... it's basically the idea you have a market, but the capital is more evenly distributed. You know, it isn't just controlled by some oligarchic group. It might even be held by, you know, I don't know, by the state or something. But you have the advantages of a market that encourages, you know, innovation and efficiency and that sort of thing. But without the concentrations of wealth that you see.
So there would still be private property, but it'd be everyone would own a little bit of property or a moderate, medium amount of property as opposed to this consolidation of wealth and total privatization.
Yeah.
But it's not a state monopoly either.
Absolutely. And obviously, I know we're not there yet, and it would take a big social disruption for it to happen. But to me, that's a much better vision, is it? Allows people to have freedom and initiative in deploying their productive resources, but without a lot of negative, you know, aspects we're seeing of the top-down control and, you know, some people being very poor and some people being very rich.
Do you want to talk about your article on the medieval systems of guilds? And I don't think you use the term neo-feudalism. I think it's the medieval guild structure. But if you want to talk about that, what are some of the misconceptions that people have about that system, and what is the case for reviving it?
Well, I think it's really an excellent system because, again, it preserves a market, but basically what you have is a lot of people who are apprentices, or they're called journeymen, who train in a trade, and their work is kind of overseen by a master craftsman for quality. And the way the guilds work, it's almost like a monopoly. There is basically price control, so the master craftsman controls the prices and the quality of the products. but it's not top-down socialism. Like, basically, every master craftsman kind of has their own domain with a few journeymen. And eventually, if the journeyman gets their work checked out and it reaches the status of being a master craftsman, then they can open up their own shop. Now, I think this could be done with modern tools like, you know, CNC machines and other home-based production machines. But I think the social model is a nice kind of third position alternative between capitalism, which we've been kind of discussing, which leads to drastically unequal outcomes, and socialism, which is even worse, which leads to top-down control and often, you know, inefficiencies and starvation and that sort of thing.
What are some of the problems of modern society that guilds would address as far as credentialism, education, and jobs?
And that's a good question. I think giving someone like a master craftsman in a particular discipline more control over directly observing a journeyman, it is better than this kind of academic credential process we have, which, you know, leads to a lot of cronyism, like, you know, their legacy admissions into the most elite colleges and universities that, you know, lead to people who don't really have that good a skill set ending up making them a lot of money in society. I think the guild system would address that to a large extent.
So you look at different systems, so like communism is an attempt of dictatorship, a rule of the working class or proletariat. Capitalism's rule of the merchant caste. Fascism is an attempt for the warrior caste to become more dominant. You have a theocracy as rule of the priestly caste. You think an ideal system would have more checks and balances, kind of like a tripartite system where you have checks and balances between all those different groups, and they would share power more because fascism, communism, and capitalism all have major problems.
Sure, and that's why I think as a social model, not as like a technical infrastructure, but as a social model, the high Middle Ages, say around 1200 after the Magna Carta and citizens did have some basic rights, is a pretty good model because you had the priest class and they acted as a check on the aristocracy and on the decadence of the lower classes, but they weren't in total control. And you had local governance, but in day-to-day practice, they didn't really interfere in your life that much. I don't know, have you ever read Hans Hermann Hoppe's Democracy, the God That Failed?
I haven't read the book, but I've listened to his speeches on YouTube.
Okay, yeah. Well, basically his idea is you're better off living in, you know, a society controlled by an aristocracy if it's decentralized and the government isn't intrusive, than in a democracy where the government is highly centralized and highly intrusive, that you actually end up having a more freedom in the, you know, the royal system or aristocratic or whatever you want to call it.
So something like enclavism could be like a confederation of like decentralized city-states.
Sure, absolutely. No, that's something I'm interested in, that kind of model. Like I've said, I'm not really an urban person, so I probably haven't thought about it in as much detail, but I do think, I think that top-down systems are breaking down for a number of reasons. I mean, one disagreement I would probably have with a lot of the writers, I think resource scarcity is a real thing, and I think it is going to have an impact on the level of technology that we're able to develop. So I think the, you know, ever-increasing centralization and long supply chains, I think, will break down in the future. I mean, I can't prove that, but that's kind of my intuitive sense of things.
How do you think decentralization in the future will adapt to technological change? Do you think technology is always a force for centralization, and to what degree are you a Luddite?
You know, that's a good question. When I read that, I really had to think about that. I would say my natural inclination is to be a Luddite. I don't know. Are you familiar with Jock Ellul's work?
No.
Okay. Well, he makes a distinction between technique and technology. And his claim is that technology requires this technique, which is basically the professional managerial class and centralization. Like, for example, you can't fly airplanes without air traffic controllers and like an FAA and all of that. That sometimes people view technology in isolation as just physical objects, but it's not just physical objects, it's also a social relation.
Do you have thoughts on the role of aesthetics in politics, and as well as aesthetics functioning as a form of societal wealth?
Sure, absolutely. Like, I don't know if you read my essay on beauty. And again, this is one I have a little bit different take than a lot of the alt-right or dissident right. I'm actually open to art from all around the world. I'm not necessarily completely Western-centric, but I do think we should look for art and aesthetics that has harmony and beauty in it. Like, for example, Balinese gamelan music, you know, is from Java and Bali, but I would argue it has the same kind of grace and beauty as, say, Western classical music. Oh, I was just going to say, and I think aesthetics are undervalued in America in particular. They've always been undervalued. It's always been kind of a hustler society.
Yeah, I mean, it is a cliche to say, but you'd say aesthetics are much less valued as a form of societal wealth compared to, say, Europe.
Yeah. I mean, de Tocqueville noticed that in the United States in like the 1820s or 1830s. Like, you know, the people that came here were strivers. You know, you were talking about strivers, I think, in the discussion of one of your essays. And I've always really had a hard time with strivers. I'd really rather either hang out with a redneck or a blue blood. These kind of in-between professional managerial people. And
yeah, America kind of really fetishizes them because, like, sometimes, like, you meet people from old money backgrounds and maybe they're a bit guarded of, like, their privacy, but they generally, they're not, they don't seem like bad people, they seem like alright people, but like the striver, they're like a middle class person who adopts this vulgar persona of what a wealthy person is, and a lot of them are pretty awful people, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I can think, someone with real wealth generally has interesting stories, like maybe they've, you know, taken a trip on the Amazon and like,
right,
or whatever, you know, they've traveled
leisure,
the world.
They have freedom and leisure to be kind of more creative, and they're not, also like a striver, they're a slave to institutions. Like, there is some distinction, there is like the independent entrepreneur, and I mean, I have like some degree of respect for someone who is like an independent entrepreneur, but the problem is that's increasingly rare and difficult, and a lot of people who claim that are kind of grifters, but I guess if they genuinely are, I respect them. But what's really disgusting about a lot of the striver types is they tailor their whole value system to like the values of like corporations, and they're pretty, a lot of them are pretty awful people. But like with people who are born into wealth, there is a sense of like, because they have that leisure, they don't have to conform to institutional values, so they can sort of be themselves more too.
Yeah, I would say a lot of these strivers just simply don't have taste. You know, they're the kind of people that might wear a big gold chain and think that having, you know, I don't know, a Lamborghini or whatever is like, you know, kind of the height of, I don't know, showing off, where someone with old wealth, you know, might have a painting by Miro or, you know, an African mask they collected. There's just, maybe it's a deeper connection of history, I think, is part of it in old wealth, whereas the new wealth is very, I think, influenced by media indoctrination.
Right, right. And now those distinctions between those two classes, that plays out in politics a lot.
Sure,
but
yeah.
One video I claim, I don't know how accurate this is, one video I claim on YouTube that talks about the economics of class said that actually, like, old money is more liberal establishmentarian and new money is more conservative. But I think there's more, I think both sides probably have, like, left and right wings to them.
And it's really, it's hard to know what that means now. Like,
so in
you know,
like in California, like really, so like in California, I guess, like what is considered old and new? Because California is a relatively new place. So I think of new money in California, I really associate it with the Silicon Valley. And you could even say, so like in my family background, like I had some people who were, who pretty well-established background in LA since like the 1920s. But I would say like even someone in California who's been well-established since even the 60s, like you could even say that's sort of old money because of how new of a place California is. But like I really think in California, like I really associate like new money with Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I mean, and I wanted to dig in, I guess, a little bit to when you said left and right, because that's such a sticky wicket now. Like,
right.
You can have a neoconservative, and you can have a paleocon or third position person, and they're both considered right-wing, but they're basically not going to agree on anything.
And obviously, so like, different, say, same with different factions of the left.
You know, so when you, to back up a little bit, it's, you know, when you're saying that one faction is conservative and the other faction is left, kind of like what faction of the right and left were you talking about? Because that was a little vague.
I guess one theory that happens, like this happens maybe more in Europe, is that old money does actually often support socialism. It's a combination of some noblesse oblige to buying off the lower classes, but it's also a mechanism to limit the wealth and prosperity of new money. Like that's one theory.
Because in the United States, I tend to think of old money as being conservative, not in the neocon sense,
right,
but more in the paleoconservative sense of, you know, being about institutions and wealth accumulation, intergenerational wealth, I guess it's called, and that sort of thing, which I tend to associate as being a conservative worldview.
And I think there's also a kind of ethnic component. So in California, like real old money is like Anglo-WASPs that goes back to like the 1920s. There's a Jewish upper class that's sort of somewhere in between. And then real new money is disproportionately now like more Asian and Indian in Silicon Valley. So these different ethnic layers too. And like in the past, like those played out too in the past.
What sort of effect do you think that has on the California culture? Because I lived in San Francisco, but that was back in like, 1991. So we're talking over 30 years ago.
Well, when was this, 1991?
Yeah, and then I actually spent some time
it's
in Humboldt County.
It's kind of funny
County
you say
too,
that, because, maybe like some of my earliest memories of visiting San Francisco were probably close to then. And I visited Humboldt County pretty recently.
Yeah, I mean, I have such mixed feelings about both San Francisco and California, and Humboldt.
But that was before the whole Silicon Valley boom.
Yeah, it was. I would say San Francisco is a beautiful city. It's very cultured. It's very friendly compared to the Midwest and East Coast, you know. If you're in an East Coast or Midwestern city, like, people do not make eye contact. And at least when I was in San Francisco, at least, I mean, admittedly, I was in kind of the hate neighborhood where people are more hippie.
Oh, right.
People were very friendly. They would just walk up to you and say, hey, man, how's it going? Blah, 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 and start, you know, talking.
San Francisco is very, it's unique. It's one of the few, it's the only major city in the Western United States that's walkable, and it also feels like sort of European.
Yeah. So that aspect of San Francisco I certainly enjoy. And I actually, you know, again, this is probably one thing where I break with a lot of alt-right people. I actually enjoy a lot of, like, avant-garde kind of art. Like,
oh, yeah.
When I was there, there was something called Survival Research Laboratories, and they had, like, robot wars and stuff, and I was so broke, I never got to see it, but I even thought just, like, seeing their flyers was cool, and I would, you know, read about it in the
scenes. Yeah, well,
there
is a faction.
Stuff like that.
There are people in, like, dissident politics who are more creative, but then you also have, like, the chuds who try to signal about how they defend more conventional norms. Like, you have that kind of the chud versus the more creative type, like, dichotomy, too.
Yeah, and I think this is something I'm actually seeing as being more exciting, is a new movement, I think you're part of it, that's starting to form where, you know, people, they have some of the values of the old alt-right, like HBD can be a topic of discussion. It's not verboten like it is on the progressive left, but I think it's not as chud-like. Like, I mean, I hate the stereotype, but a lot of chuds really do like art that's like Screaming Eagles with like talons full of missiles and stuff. Stuff that's just kitsch and tacky. And
well, that makes me think of people who are like pretty like normie MAGA type people.
Yeah. And I think there is some of that, you know, in the dissident circles. I know I'm getting a lot of pressure to vote for Trump, and honestly, I just see him as another warmonger just like Harris, so I'm really not interested in either of them. Although I am afraid if Harris gets in there that the First Amendment and Second Amendment will be under
attack.
Yeah,
I don't expect I don't expect much positive from Trump, but the one argument for voting for Trump is that Harris could do, well, she could crack down on free speech, and the other argument
absolutely
is like her open borders policy could cause like some pretty significant like transformation to the country. So I get that argument that Trump is not going to be great, but he's sort of a placeholder to prevent a lot of damage. I totally get that. I ended up just voting for RFK because I'm in California, and my vote is like, I feel as like it's purely symbolic. But on Twitter, yeah, like some of the Trump people like gave me a pretty hard time, and they're like, we have to win. Yeah. Like, you can't just do that. Like, I can vote whoever I want. Like, I,
absolutely. And again, you know, I live in the middle part of the country, so while I understand the immigration issue on an abstract level, like it doesn't directly impact me, I imagine it impacts you a lot more. Do you want to talk about that
maybe? I'm actually hearing, I think in California underwent its big immigration change pretty much like in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, and I'm actually hearing is that other parts of the country are changing now much more rapidly, because so like California has actually not really been that impacted by the whole like Biden migrant crisis in the way that Chicago, New York, Denver has.
Yeah, I mean, where I'm at, and it's complicated, I happen to be in the middle of a national forest, and I live in a county that's 90% white, so you know, basically a lot of this stuff hasn't reached us too much. But I did notice something interesting. There's a beach town about 30 miles from where I live that used to be very working class and is now kind of undergoing gentrification. And they did have
a lot of the remote workers relocating has changed a lot of areas.
Sure. And they had a big billboard with a big rainbow on it, advertising like DEI in this little beach town. And I was shocked. I was like, you don't see any of those little rainbow stickers or Ukraine stickers or any of that crap in the stores around here, like zero. So when I saw that, I was like, oh God, they're reaching us even out here in the deep woods where I have bears going through my yard. Help.
As like an artist, do you have some of the thoughts on some of the economics of the arts, how things are now, and like what obviously the stereotype, it is difficult, but how things sort of ideally should, what kind of system, economic system or patronage system would be better for arts and artists? Because I have that, you know, artist background as well.
That's a really good question. To be honest, I grew up in a family where my father sold jewelry like over the table art and craft festivals, but he was quite talented. He would win awards and stuff. He did intricate inlaid silver belt buckles with lapis and opal and that sort of thing, some of which were, you know, kind of expensive for the 70s and 80s, like $400 or $500. And but yeah, I prefer the direct sales model to some sort of institutional support, because I think it does give you more freedom, that once you're tied into some sort of funding institution, they're going to start making demands on you.
It could be too bureaucratic. That's true.
Yeah. So, yeah, and, you know, it's not my full income yet, but a substantial stream of my income is just selling these paper cuts now on Substack. I've had a lot more success with it than I thought I would have, which is, you know, gratifying.
Do you think, we sort of touched on this, but do you think conservatives and the right wings right wing in general are Philistines, like towards the arts and culture.
Yes, yes, that's my biggest, really one of my biggest complaints with the whatever we're calling ourselves this week. I know it's not, it's alt-right or dissident right or blah, blah, blah.
Post-right.
You know, post-right, post-liberal. Yeah, I do think there's a certain Philistinism that I guess it comes... I support a lot of populist politics, but I think the one downside of populist politics is it does tend to be anti-aesthetics.
And yeah, aesthetics, populism... I'm just gonna be, well, there's economic and then there's cultural populism, but populism, I mean, it makes sense in some ways, but it very much, well, it does really fetishize the worker and also, like, the small business owner, but there is a sense that populists see maybe, like, dismissive of arts as, like, too decadent or too elite, so I think that is a major problem with populism as well.
Yeah, and so I would say the arts is actually one area where I swing towards something like neo-fascism or third position, because, you know, as horrible as a lot of the things the Nazis did, and I don't support genocides or rounding people up, I think that's counterproductive. One of the things I think the Nazis did get right was they were very aesthetically oriented. Like, it was a... Now, you can argue their aesthetics were ugly, and I think some of them were, but...
They were pretty... They were pretty rigid about aesthetics. There obviously were not...
Sure, yeah.
I know.
Yeah, no, they definitely... I know they had that attack on modernist artists, the decadent art show or whatever, and that's certainly not... I don't support
that either.
Like,
the Italian fascists, like the Italian futurists, they seemed a bit more progressive towards modern art than, like, the German Nazis.
Yeah, and some of the futurists, like one of those guys, I think his name was D'Annunzio or something.
Oh, right.
He went on to become, I believe, part of the Italian fascist movement, which was, like, you know, a little less racially oriented and a little, you know, not quite as,
but yeah, I
you
think
know,
someone
I don't know,
like the thinker,
authoritarian.
The thinker Ezra Pound, and also, like, the, mm-hmm. the poet and the artist Wyndham Lewis, who both
exactly.
kind of initially, Wyndham Lewis, like, he became very more, spoke out against fascism later, but they were initially, like, fascist, and they came at fascism from sort of an artistic, the artist as, like, a ruling caste, that perspective. Yeah. But the thing about fascism is the more, like, the militaristic side that ends up, like, winning out and becoming more dominant.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I'm very familiar with Wyndham Lewis and his, he co-published a publication called The Blast, which was an early modernist magazine that published
right.
people like Ezra Pound and, you know, I believe he had illustrations from some of the futurists and that sort of thing. I do like high modernism. And I think that's, again, that's one worldview difference I have from a lot of the dissident sphere. Although there are a few people on Substack who kind of seem to be getting this, which is, again, I think there's a new movement that's very nation, and I consider you to be a part of it, that is trying to figure out how we can have things like modernist aesthetics and somewhat of a pluralism of these enclaves, but without degenerating into total decadence. And to
I
me, that's very white-pilling.
Like, I am sort of, like, a bit, I have, like, a side that's more populist and more sympathetic to, like, the working class, but, like, one area where I'm more elitist is I've noticed a lot of the positive shift is caused by people from more upper-middle-class backgrounds becoming disaffected, because I was following the scene in the, like, the whole, like, the proto sort of alt-right and, like, the paleocons and the right-wing populists and
yeah,
even white nationalists going back to, the late zeros. And what I noticed is about those people, because the original first wave were from a more kind of traditional working class, like, white working class background, they were very, like, extremely reactionary about culture. And I noticed that. I noticed as more cosmopolitan people from more upper middle class backgrounds become disaffected, you sort of see more of a shift of becoming more progressive, like being more open-minded about things, even like modern art.
I'm not sure I'd exactly call it progressive.
I don't know if that's, but, I don't know what I'd call it.
But an openness to, I don't know, say things like surrealism or, you know, the idea in urban areas, we are going to have different cultures living together. I tend to think that it will work better if people kind of have bedroom communities that are relatively ethnically homogenous, but then they go into the inner city that is more multicultural to do trade.
There's pluralism. So, like, I'm not, like, I wouldn't advocate for, obviously, complete, like, segregation, and that's totally impractical, but there has to be pluralism where certain moments where people are separate, and then other moments where people of different groups can mingle and work together and share ideas. There has to be that dualism.
Yeah, so how do you think that plays out? Again, you know, being a rural person, this is not something I think about a whole lot, but I'm certainly interested in it and interested to hear what ideas.
It's ironic. I mean, upper class white people already sort of do that. They have their bedroom community that's very white, and then they go and do business and with people of different backgrounds and engage in cosmopolitanism. So I guess populists call that parasitic, hypocritical elitists. But I think actually that's sort of a good model, should be maybe a good model for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, when you are at home, you want to be comfortable in a high trust situation and, you know, able to relax. So it makes sense you would want to be around people. To me, it's less about race and more about culture. You want to be around people that you're culturally simpatico with. But, you know, as long as the technological infrastructure exists, we are going to be in a global society. That just is what it is. It doesn't honestly make me super happy, but
it's, you know, it seems like it's inevitable to a degree.
But it seems like that sort of pluralistic solution where people have home communities or neighborhoods where they can kind of go back and decompress, but then go into an urban center or online or whatever that's more of a kind of free-for-all.
Mr. Raven, we're at the end of the show. Before we wrap up, do you want to plug your art, your Substack, or any other websites or projects that you have?
I'm pretty much exclusively on Substack these days. I got tossed off of X, Twitter, and I left Facebook a long time ago. My Substack is Whisper from the Trees. I write long essays, maybe about once a month. It varies. Sometimes I'll do two or three if I'm feeling like writing. I have music and photography, and I do this paper cut art that I described earlier where I use LLMs to generate an image, and I do that on a laser cutter and mat it. And you can order that on my Substack for $40 via PayPal shipped, or you can become a subscriber to my Substack for a year prepaid for $60 or more, and I'll send you a free paper cut.
Mr. Raven, thank you so much for being on. Great show.
Super. I really enjoyed it. Call me anytime.
Thank you for tuning in. You can follow Robert Stark on his Substack at robertstark.substack or on his website at starktruthradio.com. See you next time.